So Far from the Bamboo Grove by Yoko Kawashima Watkins, Chapter 5. Ko, tall and broad-shouldered, was well-suited to the army uniform and looked like a real soldier. Mother was short and slightly built and looked awkward in the high-necked khaki outfit. Her dusty hair was covered by a soldier's hat. Even though Ko rolled my trousers, they kept unrolling and dragging on the ground. I could not see my hands, only long sleeves flip-flopping. The baggy trousers kept falling down even when tied with the rope Mother had tied my wrist with. Ko made rope suspenders for me. But soon the edge of the trousers rubbed against my chest. My right ear was throbbing. It still felt plugged, and I could not hear when Mother or Ko talked to me from the right side. Mother comforted me. Give it a chance. But the August sun was hot on my shaved head, my mouth was dry, and my entire body ached. I whined. Gosh, whiny sister, can't you shut up for a change? Ko was disgusted. I hurt. She gave me a harsh look. Just shut up and keep on walking. I cried as I walked, wiping my eyes and nose with my uniform sleeves. Save your body water, Ko told me. With each tear, you're dehydrating yourself. I shaded my head with one hand and shed more tears over my shaved head. It will grow back, Ko said without emotion. I pitied myself for not hearing well and for constant pain in my chest, and I was mad at Ko. Shut up, she was always saying, or walk, and Mother never corrected her for her rough talk. I longed for Father. If Father were here, Ko would still be spunky but a tender sister. Finally, my crying got on Mother's nerves. Why can't you be strong and good like your honorable sister? She asked, wiping her forehead. I yelled, I'm not her. She'd cry too if she'd got hit. I would not, Ko snapped. You've done nothing but whine and fuss. This journey would be easier if you had got killed. I stopped walking and stared at her dumbfounded. My big sister wished me dead. Ko, don't you ever talk like that again, Mother said. Do you understand? Never. Ko just walked faster, faster and faster. Mother took my hand and we followed at a slower pace. The tracks were entering mountains. The shade of the tall trees was cool, and I picked leaves and sucked their juice, but it was bitter. Ko was out of sight, but suddenly her voice came from a thicket. When she appeared, she was smiling at us. Do you want a rest, little one? I was not going to speak to a sister who wished me dead. Let's rest, Mother, Ko repeated. Deep inside, I hoped we were going to rest. I was dry and starved, but mostly I longed to lie down. The pain in my ear and in my chest seemed unbearable. Mother and I kept on walking. Aren't you ever hungry? I asked Mother, because she never complained. I am very hungry and tired, but what good would it do to complain? She said. I am grateful we are alive. We must make it to Seoul and meet Hideo. She choked with tears. Ko called again, this time from the top of a hill, and waved to us to come up. We puffed our way up, and she led us to a small cave. I knew she wanted to make up for what she had said, but I sulked. I dropped my rucksack, took off the heavy, smelly uniform, threw myself on the ground, and fell asleep. Then Ko was shaking me gently. Little one, it's dinner time. Something smelled good, and I sat up. Mother was eating corn on the cob. Ko was eating a red, juicy tomato. She took an ear of corn from the campfire, rolled it in a cloth, and handed it to me. I gazed at the food with my mouth open. Eat it before it gets cold, Ko said. It's delicious. I had forgotten that I was angry at her. Where did you get it, honorable sister? I'll tell you when you've eaten. Hungry as I was, I had a hard time eating. Swallowing was difficult, and my chest felt tight. I took small bites. Ko told her story. She had looked for a stream and found a cornfield. All she thought of was bringing an armful of corn to surprise Mother and me. Then the Korean farmer caught her. He called her a damned Japanese and told her to drop the corn. Ko, in perfect Korean, had denied she was Japanese. She had told him her little sister was wounded and her mother was with her. The Japanese army police chased us away from Nanam, she told him, and we are heading for relatives in Seoul. We are starving. He asked whether she was a boy or a girl, and she told him about Mother shaving her head. The man hated the Japanese. He had been lying in wait for thieves who stole his vegetables. It would be a great day, he said, when they lost the war, and he spat on the ground. Then he let Ko fill the canteens at his well, picked ripe tomatoes for her, and gave her a burlap sack to fill with corn. Mother gave a deep sigh when Ko's story was finished. She had never expected Ko to become a liar and a robber. I had to, Ko said. She roasted all the ears of corn to take with us. For the first time since we had left home, I went to sleep without fear of attack and with a full stomach. Ko rearranged our rucksacks at dawn. Now I was to carry the light things, aluminum mess kits, knives, matches, candles. Mother had the corn. Ko carried the heaviest bundle. I had to put on the heavy uniform again. We walked. One morning, slopes began to flatten, and we saw people coming across the fields. My chest began hurting again, and my earache persisted, but I did not cry anymore, for I did not want Ko to wish I was dead. Now we saw men carrying rucksacks and bundles, and women carrying babies on their backs with a wide sash, Japanese style. Mother called, "Excuse me." They stopped and looked us over. "Are you going to Seoul?" Mother asked in elegant Japanese. They still stared at us. "We are Japanese," said Mother. "You're wearing Korean Communist Army clothes," a man said. "Excuse our appearance," Mother bowed slightly. "We had to disguise ourselves." "Where are you from?" "Far north, Nanam." "That's almost in Manchuria," the man said. "You've been walking all this time?" Mother explained about the train. Then the man told us that he had sold his barbershop in a nearby town to a Korean friend. He was returning to Japan with his relatives. "Since Koreans began attacking Japanese, we cannot sleep peacefully." Mother asked where we were. The man pointed. "The brown roof you see in the distance is the Seoul station." At last, I could not believe it. A bathhouse, Mother had said, a good place to sleep and maybe plenty to eat. Without warning, we found ourselves at the end of a seemingly endless line of people. "What is this?" Ko asked the last man in line. He wore Korean clothes, so she spoke Korean. "This is the checkpoint for escapees. We must show what we bring." These people had little to show, and we were almost there when two armed Japanese policemen, a stout one and a tall one, suddenly shouted and pointed their guns at us. I trembled, and my ear and chest began throbbing. They questioned us. We were wearing Korean Communist Army uniforms. Were we seeking political asylum? Ko told them we were Japanese. Where were we from? Could we prove this? Mother showed our insurance documents and school report cards. Finally, the men put their guns down. We had reached the head of the line now. The interrogation went on. Did we carry a large amount of money? A little cash, Mother said, bringing a pouch from her shirt pocket. They checked and gave it back. Did we have a savings book? Yes, Mother said, and looked through her bundle. She pulled out everything, but there was no savings book. I must have left it, Mother said in tears of distress. We will have to search you, they said. They went through our clothes, all our pockets, and the rucksacks, but no savings book was found. They found the roasted corn. What was this? Our food supply, Ko told them. Finally, the stout policeman asked where we were going, and Mother told him we would stay in Seoul until her son arrived. When the war was over, we would return to Nanam. The war is over, he said. We were stupefied. When? Ko asked. Yesterday. You cannot go back. That is why there are so many escapees from the north. The Japanese are in peril in Korea now. What is today? Ko asked. August 16th. Hadn't we heard about the atomic bombs dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima? No. Japan lost, the tall policeman told us. Those two cities have turned to hell. Suddenly, Mother dropped to the ground. Ko loosened Mother's collar, and as usual, I cried. Some men standing about were told to carry Mother into the station. The stout policeman ran for a bottle, and I smelled whiskey. They poured some into Mother's mouth, and Ko unbuttoned the uniform front and massaged her chest and arms. I was overjoyed when she opened her eyes. I must have blacked out. She tried to get up, but the policeman told her to stay where she was. They were friendlier now, but the interrogation continued. We were told we must be sprayed with chemicals to kill lice and bugs we might have carried from the north. We must take off our clothes. Mother got up and took off all but the thin chemise she wore under her shirt. They sprayed her from head to toe, also the uniform she had worn. I was relieved that they did not notice the short sword against her skin. Then Mother put on her own clothes. How much more comfortable she looked. Ko was next, then my turn came. The men said something and laughed, and I stood, hesitant, about removing my uniform. They say they never saw such a tiny soldier, said one. Now take off your uniform. My chemise was stained with blood. The men were shocked. You were wounded, the stout policeman said. How? Ko told him. I was sprayed, and the powder stung. I screamed. Then Mother handed me my own clothes. They were not clean, but oh, how much more comfortable I felt in them. I hoped I would never have to wear that uniform again. But Ko and Mother were folding the uniforms neatly and putting them into the clothes bundles. We have no winter clothes, Mother explained. They told us we could go, and we were leaving when the stout policeman stopped us. Have your little daughter's wound treated, he said. We followed his directions to a group of large tents with red crosses painted on their roofs. Was this the Japanese hospital? Ko asked a medic who sat at a desk outside. Right, he told her. He saw my blouse stained with blood. Come, he said. He took my sack, and Mother and Ko followed to a cot where he told me to lie down. He took off my blouse. A young doctor came. I am Dr. Takeda, he said. Mother and Ko bowed. He pulled up a small stool and asked my name. Kawashima Yoko. How old? Almost 12. He was filling in a form. Tell me what happened. I told him about my ear aching and being deaf. He asked about how long, and I told him 6 days. When he pulled my chemise carefully from the wound and examined my injury, he shook his head. I don't see how she could have stood it all this time. It's badly infected. My little sister did very well, Coke told him. He sterilized the place beneath my right breast that was burned and infected, applied medicine, and the medic put an antiseptic gauze and wrapped my chest. Now let me see your ear. The doctor put a round mirror with a hole in the center on his head. He pulled my earlobe down and inserted a long, thin wire. Tears streaming, I gritted my teeth and saw Mother's agonized face. He showed me a piece of metal. This was in your ear. Your eardrum has been punctured and it is infected. He drained the infection, dropped in some medicine, and stuffed cotton in my ear. As he added information to his form, he asked, By chance, is your father's name Yoshiro? Yes, Mother said. I know him, said the doctor. My father and your husband were classmates at the university. My father is Kazuzu Takeda. He's a member of the House of Peers. They get together at our house every year after their alumni association meeting. I know him, Mother cried. Dr. Takeda told her that he had been assigned to the Japanese Army Hospital here 6 months ago, before the war ended. He asked Mother her plans, and she told him about waiting for Hideo. Your little daughter should stay in the hospital, he told her. She is badly infected and needs treatment every day. I was given a mat in the crowded patient's tent, and Mother stayed with me that night while Ko took her blanket, canteen, and 2 ears of corn back to the station. Mother fell asleep guarding what little we possessed, but throbbing and burning and disturbed by the cries of the other patients, I could not sleep. In the night, the medic brought me powdered medicine in transparent paper, and at last I drifted off. The sun was bright when I woke, and Mother was combing her hair. It was more gray than black now, and her face, once so beautiful, was deeply lined. She smiled at me, tying her hair at the back. Wake up now, little one. The doctor was here, but he let you sleep. He wants to change your dressing. She handed me a damp cloth, and I wiped my face. Here's the canteen. Wash your mouth outside and go see the doctor. My ear felt no better, and I could not hold my head upright. The doctor took out the cotton, wet with pus, cleaned with the swab, and dropped in more medicine. Again, I shed tears with the pain. He told me the swelling would go away and that I must have complete rest. Then the medic bandaged my chest. I was leaving when the doctor stopped me and handed me a bottle of milk. Each patient has a bottle a day, he told me. I stared at the creamy milk. Holding the precious treasure in both hands, I stood still. Then I gathered my courage. May I beg 2 more bottles? For your honorable mother and sister, the doctor asked. I nodded. He nodded too, and the medic gave me 2 more. I bowed to them deeply and walked as fast as I could to where Mother waited. I stayed in the hospital tent 2 weeks, Mother and Co. taking turns being with me. As I watched Mother walking now, I saw that her walk was feeble. She seemed smaller and smaller. Either Mother or Ko was always at the station, waiting for Hideo's arrival, but there was no Hideo. On September 1st, the doctor spoke with Mother. All patients will leave for Busan by truck by the end of the month. A hospital ship will be leaving from there for Japan on October 2nd. Come with us back to our homeland. But Mother would wait for Hideo. So on the last day of my hospital stay, Dr. Takeda gave us 3 bottles of milk, extra bandages, medicine, and cotton. He said I had made a good recovery, but must take things easy and not catch a cold. He gave me a bottle of aspirin, 1 tablet every 3 hours when the pain comes. He and Mother promised to meet in the homeland, fate willing. We carried all of our belongings back to the station. The station was crowded with escapees from the north who had not found homes, Japanese soldiers released from the army, and civilians all wanting to take the train to Busan. We sat outside, and whenever a train, passenger, or freight pulled in, Mother and Ko would dash to the platform. I was to save our spot and guard our belongings. No Hideo. We drank some milk. There was no food when night came. When Ko said there would be no train until early morning and we must sleep. We found a small space on a bench in the waiting room, and Ko squeezed Mother into it. She pushed our clothes bundle under the bench, and she and I catnapped at Mother's feet. As the night advanced, I was so cold that I shivered and my ear and chest ached. I crawled out. I'm cold, I said to Mother. She took me on her lap and wrapped us both in her blanket. Secure in her arms, I went to sleep. But sometime later, there was a violent altercation with the man next to Mother, who complained that I had kicked him. I hadn't meant to, but Mother told Ko to give her the clothes bundle, and she pulled out my red overcoat and got it on me. She got out the Communist Army uniform and ordered me to put it on over the overcoat. Then she sent me back to my bed under the bench, where I cuddled up to Ko for warmth. Mother was on the platform when the early train pulled in. Our neighbor tried to take her place while she was gone, but Ko said she would kill him with her peeling knife, and he backed off. Mother came back without Hideo, and we drank the last of our milk. I will go and find food, Ko said, and took her empty rucksack. Another train came in, and Mother rushed to the platform. Then an elderly Japanese crawled under the bench and tried to take our clothes bundle. He claimed it was his. It was only when Mother returned and shouted, "Help! Thief!" that he gave up. Ko came back with her rucksack partly filled with food from the hotel garbage. Mother was almost speechless at the cunning Ko had developed and her technique of swimming through danger. While we lived at the station, the American soldiers came to Seoul. Confined to our small area, we hardly ever saw them. One day, when Ko returned, she brought out from the rucksack some orange and apple peelings and several slices of bread. She had taken them from garbage cans at the former Japanese hospital, now used by the American medical team. We needed to bathe. We dared not leave our belongings at the station, so we carried everything to the river. Autumn had come now, but still many people were bathing. Ko and Mother went into the water in chemise and panties, while I stayed with the belongings. I saw Ko duck her head in the water, and Mother soaped it and began to shave. The sword's short blade sparkled again and again. Then it was my turn. The water was very cold, and Mother's fingers soaping my back and my head, careful to avoid my chest and not get water in my ear, were icy. Even colder was the sharp blade that slid over my head. Mother changed my dressing and put drops in my ear. She said the new skin was growing nicely. I put on dry underwear, and Ko rinsed all of our wet underclothes and spread them on the rocks to dry. We had been in Seoul for 5 weeks when one day Ko brought a warning. We must get out of Seoul. I saw several Korean men dragging girls to the thicket, and I saw one man raping a young girl. Ko was shivering. The girls were screaming for help in Japanese. "Will you shave my hair again now?" At the river, Mother shaved both our heads. Then she bound Ko's breast tightly with the long cloth Dr. Takeda had used to wrap my chest so that she would look even more like a boy. We all put on our filthy uniforms, protection against the chilly autumn air. Back at the station, our spots were taken, so we sat outside in the warmth of the sun. Mother interviewed the station master. She told him we could not afford to ride to Busan as passengers and would have to go on a freight car. He told her so many were heading for the port that he doubted we could even get on. The trip took 2.5 days. "Let us take last freight train tomorrow," Mother decided. "Perhaps Hideo will be on it when it comes." Ko and I carved word to Hideo on the station posts and wherever we went found wood. "Hideo, to Busan," I carved, hoping desperately that he would come before we left. Then Ko took me to the narrow alley of the hospital and told me to hunt for food in the garbage cans. I opened a can and the strong, rotten smell went through my nose. I could not put my hand into that garbage. "Do it," Ko ordered sharply. She was poking through a can with her jackknife. Already her sack was half filled. I gagged. "I cannot, honorable sister." "Go find sticks," Ko said. Finally, with chopsticks, I found, she showed me how to look for food. I found a half-eaten jelly sandwich, a meat sandwich, and lots of potato strips fried in oil, some cheese and lettuce. These were our food supplies for the train trip. We rushed back to where Mother guarded our belongings, ate, and sat through the night. It was 3 o'clock the next afternoon when the last freight train pulled in. In vain, we looked for Hideo. Everyone, Japanese, Koreans, young, old, children, feeble people, were trying to get on the train. Mother held my hand tightly, and Ko, ahead of us, made her way, bumping people with her large bundle. The first boxcar was packed. "No room," a man shouted. The next one was even worse, and still many were trying to crawl in. Others were clinging to the edge of the train. "Try the flat car," Ko yelled. The train whistled. The flat car was piled with lumber and people, but a Japanese man on the train called to us, "Come here, quick." Ko handed him her bundle. Knowing my chest was tender, she lifted me like a baby and handed me to the man, who dropped me on some lumber and extended his arms to Mother. She was on. Ko tossed up our rucksacks. The train whistled 3 times and began moving. "Honorable sister, hurry," I screamed. She jumped, the man pulled, and he and Mother pulled Ko onto the car. "Oh," Mother bowed deeply to the man, "thank you." "A close call," he replied. I saw him now for the first time, elderly, with a white beard, with a gentle way of speaking. We swayed on the flat car, and the wind blew so hard that when Ko opened my rucksack, the wind almost blew our food away. She handed our elderly friend a cheese sandwich. "I have not eaten for 3 days," he told her, and devoured it. Night came, and I shivered with cold. Ko and Mother got out coats and uniforms, clutching them tightly lest the wind take them away. Wrapped in my blanket, too, I clung to Ko. In the morning, we ate whatever was not spoiled of the fruit, sharing with the old gentleman. Ko gave him bread, and he was overjoyed. "This is moldy, but better than none," he said. At one point, the train stopped, and we watched a man jump off, turn his back, and urinate. Then he called to us, "If you have to go, go now. No telling when we'll stop again." We managed to get off and squat right there, shielding each other. On the train jolted south to Busan. Now I felt not only cold, but feverish. My throat was sore, and I had lost my voice, but I did not whine because these were nothing compared with the pain I had been through with ear and chest. And at last, on the third day, the train pulled into the Pusan station. The station was packed. We must go to the warehouse by the harbor. I must wait here for my son, Mother told a Korean official. You cannot. We are going to have our independence celebration here. Go. I did not think I could walk an inch farther, but I was burning with fever now, and my head pounded. But we dragged on. Koreans of all ages, dressed in their best and carrying flags, were heading for the celebration at the station. And there were American soldiers, too, with cameras. The warehouse had belonged to the Japanese Navy until the war ended, and slogans were still large on the walls. Victory! Attack with courage! Great Imperial Navy! Now the warehouse was filled with people. Again it was Ko who found a corner, and I put my blanket on the concrete floor and fell asleep. But I was not allowed to sleep long. A man was yelling at me, telling me to sit up and make room for him. Mother told him I was ill, but he looked about to choke her. At that, I grabbed his legs and he fell. Angrier than ever, he got up and came toward me, threatening. Then I saw Mother, the sword blade pointing at his chest. Try and touch her, she said in a low voice. And the man went away. Lie down, little one, Mother said, as if nothing had happened. Save your sister's spot. She put the blade into its sheath. Ko brought orange peels and rotten apples she had found near a mess hall. There were peaches, too, and plenty of those fried apple strips. I have to go to the toilet, I said. There were six toilets at the end of the building for us to squat on, but no doors and no separate toilets for men and women. A woman ahead of us, embarrassed, pulled down her trousers and panty and squatted, and I tried not to look at her. Then Mother went and stood in front of her, and I saw the young woman come out. In a moment, she screamed for help. I turned to see that she had been seized by four men at the end of our line. There was nothing we could do. When we got back to our space, Ko wanted to go. Mother's lips were pale. Is the wrapper around your breast tight? She asked. Ko, you must do it the way boys do. From then on, we did it the way boys do. It was awful. We were wet and our clothes were wet, but we were safer. That day was a nightmare. Drunken Koreans celebrating their independence were all around us. One who swayed back and forth demanded of Ko, are you a boy or a girl? A boy, she answered. You sound like a girl. Let me feel. Go ahead, Ko said. How I prayed someone would come to rescue us. No one was trying to help young women, for they knew that if they made the Koreans even angrier, they might burn down this warehouse and the people in it. The Koreans were free of the Japanese Empire after all those years. The drunken man put his large hand on Ko's chest. Flat, he said. Boys are no fun. The group of men left us, but they staggered among the people, hunting maidens for their pleasure. And whenever they found one, they dragged her outside. Women's shrieks echoed. Mother and Ko did not sleep that night. In the morning, their eyes were bloodshot, and they looked worn out. Ko said she must sleep, and I must go for food. She gave me directions. Voice still missing, head pounding, throat aching, ear throbbing, I put my rucksack on my head, as the Koreans did, and headed for the building Ko had directed me to. With a maple branch broken from a tree, I poked through garbage cans. There were milk cartons with a few drops in them, flour in bags. We could make a fire outside and mix flour and water for dumplings. There was bread half eaten. Browned bananas, what a treasure! I ate a banana as I poked through. Soon I put my filled sack on my head and started back. At a small stream, I stopped to drink, and I heard a cry. In the weeds was a Korean man on top of a girl. She was kicking wildly and screaming. My knees began to shake, and holding my sack on my head with both hands, I walked as fast as I could to Ko and Mother. We cannot stay here any longer, Mother said when I told her. We must get to Japan. Her eyes filled. But Hideo, he will be all alone in Korea. A week later, it was announced that a cargo ship was coming and could take 100 people to Japan. Japanese must surrender any dangerous weapons, guns, knives. We must get in line for the ship. With all the others, we scrambled for the line. I cannot surrender our precious sword, Mother whispered. You must not, Ko agree. Let us go to the toilet. Stay in line and guard our belongings, little one. When they came back, Ko was walking strangely, her left leg not bending. Little one, said Mother in a low voice, your sister's leg is wounded. She has a cast on it. You understand? I nodded. When the ship finally docked, the Korean official counted 100. 97, 98, 99, 100. There was a cry. Please, officer. It was a middle-aged Japanese woman. Please let my father come with me. No, the rule is the rule. This official, like all Korean officials, looked harsh to me. That is what your government always said to us. He's old and he needs my care. I will pay, please. The rule is the rule. Then a man behind the old father offered to change places, so both the woman and her father stayed behind. I watched the boat fade away toward the horizon, and I wondered how long I would have to wait until I was on board a ship to the homeland I had dreamed of all my life. 100 had left, but more hundreds poured in, and we continued to wait in line, not daring to leave lest we miss our chance on the next boat. A week later, the ship returned, but we were not among this 100. Mother continued to search among the crowds for Hideo. Ko, walking awkwardly, her left leg stiff, went searching for food. Rain came. We covered ourselves with our blankets, but soon we were soaked. It rained for 3 days, and we sat on the ground, in line, day and night. Our belongings were sodden. I began to cough, and Ko remembered the aspirin Dr. Takeda had given us. Somehow, it had slipped our minds until now. We all took aspirin, crushing the sour tablets with our teeth. At last, we saw the ship again, and when Ko went to the toilet, she counted the people. We were 79, 80, and 81. They began loading early in the morning. As each one walked onto the gangplank, Korean officials inspected belongings. They touched our bodies to make sure we were not carrying concealed weapons. They searched me first, and I winced with pain when my chest was touched. Then I began to cough and could not stop. I pulled up my uniform jacket to show where I was bandaged. "Go," the official said. I was afraid for Ko, carrying our family treasure. The official checked her sack and found nothing but food from the garbage. He touched her chest, sides, back, and hips. His hands moved toward her thigh. Ko's face was white, and I trembled. The official must feel the gauze that tied the sword. He was feeling the gauze. "My leg is wounded. Don't press hard. You're hurting me." Ko grimaced as if in pain. "Go," said the man. I made myself stay calm. They let Mother through easily with the filthy, damp clothes in her bundle, but they took the small nail scissors. There was space on the ship, and we spread a blanket and sat on it. Ko handed me a slice of moldy bread, and I wiped off the mold on my trousers and ate it. When the sun tinted the sea a brilliant red, the boat slowly left the dock. "At last, no more fear," said Ko. She leaned against the rail. "At last. Soon I would be meeting my grandmother and seeing my beautiful homeland." I joined Ko at the rail. Mother sat still on the blanket, head buried in her arms. Her hair, all gray now, blew in the wind. Ko kept staring at the Korean peninsula, fading away slowly, and tears were falling on her cheek. It was the first time I had seen Ko cry since we left home. Quietly, I went to sit close to Mother, whose face was also wet with tears that she could not stop.